Fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, is a process that involves injecting water, chemicals, and sand into the cracks of the earth at high pressure to widen the cracks and allow for extraction of oil and gas, in the case of the UK, only gas, from shale formations. The ban was introduced in 2019 when an earthquake occurred near Britain's only remaining fracking site. Fracking sites are known to release various forms of toxins and pollutants into the air, including chemicals that can cause severe headaches, asthma symptoms, childhood leukemia, cardiac problems, and even birth defects. Among the 1,000-plus chemicals used in fracking, some are even known to cause cancer. But those were only the negative effects of fracking on humans. For the environment, the vast amount of wastewater and greenhouse gases released, such as methane, will cause irreversible harm. The US isn't hit as hard as the EU as a result of the war in Ukraine, so their arms sales that will in effect prolong the war might even have a net positive effect for the country. But the EU that is hurting the most from the war is getting the short end of the stick. They are scrambling for other means of energy procurement, and the US might just be their last resort. A US that has increased its price of gas for an increasingly desperate Europe, in dire need of energy, waiting for a difficult winter.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war, but our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent. Even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction. And that could spell nuclear Armageddon. North Korea's barrage of missiles is sending the U.S. another message other than military and missile capabilities. North Korea has been under severe U.S. sanctions. For starters, it has sanctioned properties and belongings of the Workers' Party of Korea. Freezing the property of members of the Workers' Party of Korea essentially amounts to stealing from everyday Koreans, as the party's membership stands at 6.5 million people, or a quarter of North Korea's population. Harsh U.S. bilateral and U.N. sanctions have had particularly devastating effects on the North Korean economy. The list of industries directly targeted include the mineral trade, seafood, textiles, and agricultural products. Previous talks between the U.S. and North Korea hinged on the elimination of these sanctions in return for Pyongyang to stop its ballistic nuclear program. But the U.S. was not willing to give any concessions, resulting in a stalemate. Meanwhile, the U.S. believes that China and Russia have the leverage to persuade North Korea not to resume nuclear bomb testing. But why should they do that? Given the Ukraine conflict and how U.S. feels about Russia and U.S.'s appetite for confrontation with China, either militarily or when it comes to trade, this idea seems far-fetched. perhaps a grand bargain can be reached between the U.S., Russia, and China when it comes to North Korea, if the desire is there before it is too late. And as far as U.S. foreign policy goes, it has failed in many respects. When it comes to countries like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, well, the list is long. The current U.S. President Joe Biden, like many of his predecessors, has failed to execute a clear diplomatic path to reach solutions for provocation and military aggression.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabot Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic, and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdollahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzor Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails, and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. the work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how disinformation is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
که این صفت مخصوص زن نیست اما چرا حضرت برای زنان خواسته چون
chastity and honor is not limited to women only. However, Imam al-Mahdi in a supplication asks Allah to give women such attributes. But why? This is because if a woman is deviated in a society, the whole society will be deviated. Thus, if a woman in society is deviated, the man of that society will be deviated too. The moral downfall of the women will make a society deviated too.
زن اصلا محور تربیته. همون جور که در خانواده محور تربیت هست.
Woman is the pivot of moral nurturing in both family and society. If a woman is deviated morally, then the man is deviated too. That's why all our infallibles, especially Imam al-Mahdi, ask Allah to give the women of a society the sense of chastity and honor. This way, a society can develop spiritually too. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Joe Biden has asked oil companies to increase supply and lower prices at their own expense, while threatening them with higher taxes. But will it help the Democrats' election chances? Stay tuned for more. In this regard, RT provided an op-ed to shed more light on this issue, writing, "In direct opposition to the Democratic Party's green agenda, U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered the oil industry to ramp up production and lower prices or else. But does the U.S. leader have the power to control the free market? As public sentiment over the U.S. economy begins to boil, Biden is attempting to shift the blame onto the oil industry for hoarding profits while keeping prices at the pumps excessively high, thereby strangling economic growth. It's time for these companies to stop war profiteering, meet their responsibilities in this country, and give the American people a break and still do very well," Biden told reporters in the White House this week, adding, "If they don't, they're going to pay a higher tax on their excess profits and face higher restrictions." The U.S. leader said he would work with Congress to look at these options that are available to us and others. It's questionable, however, how the Democrats will be able to build bipartisan consensus for such penalties against the oil industry when the Republicans, who stand a good chance of winning the House come November 8, are openly hostile to any new stifling taxes. Although gas prices in the U.S. have decreased by $1.25 per gallon from a summer peak, the current national average is $3.76 per gallon, which is still more than 35 cents higher than this time last year. At a time when inflation has gone through the roof for everything from food to utilities, those extra pennies make a difference. Meanwhile, the oil industry, which continues to post astronomical profits, rejects Biden's claims that the American people are being left out of the bonanza. The CEO of ExxonMobil Corp, Darren Woods, said his company is dividing profits among shareholders. Woods told Bloomberg News, "There has been discussion in the U.S. about our industry retaining some of our profits directly to the American people. That's exactly what we are doing in the form of our quarterly dividend." The White House fired back on Twitter several hours later, saying, "Can't believe I have to say this, but giving profits to shareholders is not the same as bringing prices down for American families." Biden mentioned something in his White House speech that reflects his administration's short-sighted expectations of the oil industry at a time when the Democrats are attempting to enforce its green agenda on the American people. "Record profits today are not because they are doing something new or innovative. The profits are a windfall of war," Biden said in reference to the crisis now raging between Russia and Ukraine. The question many observers are asking is, why didn't the White House wait until those new and innovative technologies were online before canceling everything in one throw? While the Democrats blame Russia, big oil, and OPEC for America's current economic woes, on his first day in office, President Biden shut down oil and gas exploration in the Arctic National Wildfire Refuge, prohibited drilling in the state of Utah and canceled the Keystone XL pipeline between the United States and Canada, Donald Trump's signature project that would have already largely reduced American dependency on oil supplies from the volatile West Asia region and beyond. Canadian oil would have flowed into the United States as freely as other things on top. To top it off, Biden announced in March a ban on Russian oil and other energy imports in retaliation for Moscow. Did he really think energy prices would stay put after those moves? Instead of waiting until the U.S. economy had made a full transition to renewable energy, the Democrats severed the country from its very lifeline. This has put the United States at the complete mercy of big oil, which is behaving with all the rapaciousness to be expected in a country built on the capitalist ethos. As long as the oil industry keeps shareholders happy, they can argue they are spreading the wealth, despite the fact that those investors who are now reaping a windfall make up a tiny percentage of the U.S. population and contribute little to economic growth overall. And now Biden and the Democratic Party find themselves scrambling to clean up a mess of their own making, with green crusaders screaming for windmills, solar power, and electric cars. The White House has been forced to take 180 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR, now drained to its lowest level since 1984, while asking the oil industry to increase supply and reduce prices. Yet Biden may ultimately find himself snubbed by big oil, as much he was by America's Persian Gulf allies, particularly Saudi Arabia, when he asked them to increase oil production. While it may seem an honorable undertaking for the United States to wean itself from a planet-killing oil addiction, to do so without a backup plan is simply economic and political suicide.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the effects of faith. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Iman, which is known as faith, it is related to the beliefs that we have. Therefore, it is said by Imam Ali alayhi salam that al-Imanu ma'arifatun bil-qalb. Iman, faith, is something that you acknowledge with the heart and you accept it with the heart. Wa iqrarun bil-lisan, and you confirm it with your tongue. وَعَمَلٌ بِالْأَرْكَانِ, and it is the practice of what has come in the Islam. And in the other hadith, he also said, أَسْلُ الْإِيمَانِ, the essential of Iman or the faith is حُسْنُ التَّسْلِيمِ لِأَمْرِ اللَّهِ, that we are submissive to all the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we practically do something, when we practically practice Islam, then obviously it can be said that this person has become a mu'min, or he has faith, he is faithful. Therefore, there are some effects of Iman. And the very first effect which we're going to talk is that when someone becomes a believer and he gets to the status of Iman, he gets to the status of Iman, he has the feeling of love towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and towards the world, which is taking him near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the very first thing is that we can see that the people who are faithful, who has iman, they never commit suicide. They never become depressed. They are not upset. Yes, there are hardships. There are things that comes in their life, but they take it as a trial and they show patience. Therefore, because they are warm, their hearts are warm of the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, therefore, they tackle all these things very easily. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. And therefore, we mentioned the first effect, that the one who is faithful, who has reached to the level of iman, he basically is the one who has, whose heart is warm with the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, he knows the love of Allah, how is it? The second effect is that he has a peace of, like, the peace, the spiritual peace, we can say, the peace in his spirit and in his body. His body feels peaceful when he is reached to the iman. Why? Because when he performs something, he knows that I'm doing this for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He avoids to perform bad deeds. He avoids the evil. And even if in some case he is committing a sin and he has done it, he immediately seeks forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He repents to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, he knows the way that by mistake, if he has committed a sin, how to ask for forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, this brings peace for his spirit. He is close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The way it is said in the Quran that Allah bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qurub, in chapter Ra'ad, verse number 28. Allah, let it be known that in the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is a peace, tatma'innu al-qurub. It is a peace for the heart. Therefore, his heart is full of peace. And he is always in the state of peace. He does not need to go to exercise something, maybe like, you know, in today's world, in order to get the spiritual peace, people go for yoga, they go for other kinds of things, and they try to have exercise. Yes, exercise is necessary for the body, and that gives strength to the body. But on the other hand, for the spiritual peace, when you're connected to God, when you're connected to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously this connection brings peace to the hearts. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades, according to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. Through a combination of ground combat, airstrikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous," wrote Catherine Young, a Bright counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. "The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations," she added. "These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 authorization for use of military force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the covert action statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA. The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A Bright document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercury 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members." Congress's understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding, "The Department of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch." Ebrard's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Dana Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab, and later the state in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebrard notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Dana Brigade from 2011. Under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities, before the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade. Over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and failed strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before the so-called War on Terror. forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, "Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith Through Action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. Now, Imam Zainul Abideen wants to defend the following thesis, that humbling oneself before Allah, weeping to Allah, worshipping and supplicating to Allah is to polish the soul, to make oneself more determined, to make oneself more reliant on Allah and not to slacken. He wants to defend this thesis, but this Shia layperson also has an erroneous understanding that he wants to correct. What would you say? Look at the Imam's words. Let us not speak of my father, my mother and my grandfather. Paradise is for the obedient. This is the thesis of Shia Islam with regard to faith and actions. Why am I placing so much emphasis on this issue? Because for many years, centuries even, the idea has been put into the minds of Muslims that it is not necessary to do anything in order to be a Muslim. They have been told that all you need to be a believer is a pure heart. You don't need to do anything else. And we have helped our enemies foster this idea in our minds through our own indolence and laziness.
دنیای
اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We think that we are going to paradise and it will be given to us for the slightest thing. This false notion has been so successful in spreading because people are ignorant and they want to believe this is true. They had no other motive in spreading this idea save that they were ignorant. In fact, it was only a short time after the Prophet that this idea came into existence and began to spread. In the early centuries of Islam, one day people saw that Muawiyah was advising his followers that when he died, there were two packages that they should bring and bury with him in his grave. They asked, "What are these things?" He tells them that one of the packages contains a piece of the Prophet's clothes. As for the other, well, one day the Prophet was trimming his hair or nails, and some clippings fell on the ground, which Muawiyah said to his followers, "Put these in my grave so that Allah forgives me." Do you see, even Muawiyah hoped for the Prophet's intercession and tried to obtain it. But how did he do this? By taking some hair or nail clippings from the Prophet. Bravo! He was willing to strive to the extent that it was easy, to the extent that it was no cost to him. He will listen to the Quran, he will respect the Quran, but only to the extent that it is useful for him.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one.
Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Gio Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark, but 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Gio Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the